Welcome to Program Optimization. Last time we looked at the functional programming languages, and we thought about inlining, and we kind of considered it useful to have a value analysis. So a value analysis takes an determines for every expression, for every sub-expression of the program, collects for every sub-expression of the program potential values of that expression. Now, what is what is a value? That is another question. And what is a value, and now how do we determine sets of values? Because sets of values can be, in a certain sense, infinitely many. So, for example, if some variable may, in different contexts, may evaluate to a list, then there could be lists of arbitrary length. And if you don't know the length, then this could be infinitely many. And the question is, how do we represent all these lists? So here is a way how we can do it. And the idea will be that we will represent them as a grammar, as a kind of context-free grammar describing all the values. So it's a kind of context-free grammars typically, as we know them, are used to represent sets of strings. But here we have structured terms. So in that sense, we need a variation of context-free grammars which produce structured terms. And such things are also called tree grammars. And in this case, they are, in fact, regular tree grammars. But if you don't like the notion of tree grammars, you might also simply consider it as a context-free grammar. And only that you have opening and closing brackets, so that you have some kind of, which in the application turns the generated output string into a term. So now let us assume that we now, what is a value? So a value is something of the following form. Either it is a constant, a b, or a basic constant C, or a basic constant B, or a constructor applied to basic values, or a tuple, or an operator applied to values, or a function. And if it's a function, so then the body is, so there are only finitely many functional expressions in the program, so it's one of these. And now the question is, how do we kind of describe all the set of all such possible values in to which an expression may evaluate? So for that we kind of put up a constraint system. So the constraint system has variables. So these are these variables. So for every expression we have a variable. And now if it's a sub-expression, so we have only variables for sub-expressions of the program. So that's the key point. For the unknowns, we will never create new expressions. So we only take those. So that guarantees us that that we only speak about finitely many unknowns. So each of these sub-expressions of the program, for that we have an unknown. And if this is one of these, if this expression is already a value, then we say it may evaluate to that value. Yeah, that's the trivial case. Now, the question is now, if what happens if we have an expression which is not just a value. So that means it is of the form, for example, one expression applied to another expression. So what then would we do? Well, this is a function application, so now everything determines the set of values to which E evaluates de- depends on the functions to which E1 evaluates. Now, there are only finitely many functional expressions in our program. Now, and if one such functional expression is a potential value of the E1, what do we know then? Well, then the every value to which its body may evaluate may be a value of E. So that's this constraint. And if this F is not a potential value of E1, well, then this constraint will not add any further element to the values of E. So you understand the trick? Now, if you look at that first constraint in isolation, this is a bit weird, because this means that the values of E do not depend on the values of the argument expressions E2 at all. This is weird. But what happens here is that a second constraint is generated, namely that given that F is a value of E1, then the values of E2 are potential values of the formal parameter. So that gives us this second constraint. So you see here, so then that means, and since the values of the formal parameter may contribute to the value of the body of the values of the E prime, but that indirectly also the values of E2 are passed to the function and then used in the evaluation of the body. Okay? Now, what else can we have? Now, then let's see what other expressions we have in our program. Well, if we have a let expression, then the value of E1 will contribute to the values of the local variable X1, and the values of E0 will contribute to the value of E. Okay, now we said on the top level we have this let rec expression, and then this simply means that the right hand sides contribute to the values of the names representing their left hand sides, and the value of the E0, this is the value of the overall expression T. Okay. And now there is one more thing which is not all what can happen in a program. There are further kinds of expressions. So, for example, if we have an operator application, then then they may return int values, or they may return Boolean values. And that means if we have a test, then this means we don't know the precise, if there's an if then else, and if, for example, fx equals 5, then do this, otherwise do that. So since we do not evaluate operator applications, so we could consider these as unevaluated terms, we will not be able to decide whether a value will be 5 or not. And that means that in this case, we approximate if-then-elses on integers, or pattern matching on integer data types as non-deterministic choice. Therefore, if you have a match expression like that, and if we have one of the patterns is a basic value like 5, true, false, things like that, then without doing any check, we assume that the whole expression may evaluate to this case. And that is if all these patterns here are basic values or Boolean values, integer values or Boolean values, then we simply go for, we make non-deterministic choice. Now then comes, then we may proceed to other cases. So if this pattern matching refers to some other data type, so that means these among the patterns are constructor applications. And then we look at all the value sub-expressions, all the sub-expressions of the program, which start with a construct, with the same constructor. And then we say, if this sub-expression of the program here is something. Yeah, if this sub expression of the program is a possible value of e zero, then the corresponding the expression for the corresponding alternative may contribute to the values of the whole expression E, and likewise that is kind of for the value of E. Likewise, at that there is the values of this one may contribute to the Y one. And that we do also kind of parameter passing in a separate set of constraints, and that happens here. So if this value expression occurs somewhere in the program and is appears in this appears. Here, in here, appears in here, then we evaluate, let that contribute to the corresponding variable y. And likewise, I made a little bit of a mistake. Let me go back here to this original setting. So I kind of was a little bit. I made a little bit of a mistake. Let me kind of have a separate page here. So for assume that we have a program like. A program like that. And a sub expression like that. One x two. Yeah. So that then this is let that be our expression E. So then what would we put? So what is the idea here? So this is, and that we could put another expression e1. So this is e0. E1 would be the expression, fun x to e prime applied to e0. For example, that. So now these are two example expressions. What would we expect? What is this set V which we compute? We want to have a value. The analysis computes a value for this E0. That was this sharp thing. And it will determine a value for the E1 in these brackets. So these should be should represent the set of possible values to which these expressions evaluate. So that is what I said, and this is perfectly true. But now I missed a little bit of a point, and that I would like to now correct myself. The analysis cannot compute infinite sets, so it will compute it will assign to each of these a subset of finitely many expressions. It will assign a subset of finitely many expressions. Now, what expressions would we need? So these expressions are sub-expressions. So these beasts are also sub-expressions of the program, which are not precisely values, but value-like, in that sense that they kind of either are functions, so this is one category, like this one, or they have an outermost constructor. An outermost constructor. What is an expression with an outermost constructor? This is an expression with an outermost constructor. The whole thing here is also an expression with an outermost constructor, namely the tuple. Yeah? So these expressions with an outermost constructor will also be put into the V, and also operator applications. Inside there could be functional things and so on. But that is kind of the subset of things. So in that sense, this set V of kind of value-like sub-expressions are only values for the, either they are functions or values with respect to the top constructor. So that is kind of the our moderate assumption, and we later will be able to use these expressions to derive all possible values. So I hope, I'm sorry that I made that confusion, but that was kind of this is the idea of the analysis, and that is what is, yeah, so the potential values are sets of these beasts, and so if E is value type, yeah, it's not a value, but it's a value like, then we, it is contained here, so that is still true. And also this, what I explained here is still true, and also these arguments, what I explained here, all that is still true. But now it comes to, when we come now here to this situation, then we have, then this beast here, this V, which is contained in E0, so it says, so you see here that this is a sub-expression of the program with an outermost constructor, which matches the pattern in this case. Yeah. So this means, yeah. So that would be the situation, and then, so this means if this kind of program expression arrives in the E0, then we know that the case for the where the C is in the pattern is selected. And that means that the corresponding alternative will contribute to the value of the match expression, and the corresponding sub-expression E prime J will contribute to the corresponding variable. So that is, sorry for that, and that is kind of the idea here, and a similar situation for the tuple. And now what happens if the pattern is a variable alone, that is this case, well then it would match anything, so that means that this case could always be taken, and that therefore we have this inclusion here. And then then we would have this inclusion here, and then we have and also all values arriving in the match expression will then be potential values of the Y. Now that was kind of the rules of the analysis. Let's see for a concrete program. and it should be a very simple program, what the impact, how the analysis, what the, how it would kind of behave. So here we have this app function, which is now which is dear to us, and this is applied in a particular expression, namely this one, where app is called with the lists 1, 2, and list 3. And we want to know what will the analysis do with it. Yeah? So first, what is the... well, here I have already written simply the result of the analysis, but we might easily kind of convince ourselves that this is how that happens. So what is the possible value of the of the name, the possible values of the name up? Well, up is defined by this functional expression. And so this is a kind of, if you like, this is a value. So there is a constraint, up contains that value, and nothing else is put into the variable up. So therefore, the value of returned by the analysis for up is the functional expression on the right-hand side. The functional abstraction on the right-hand side. Now, what happens for the variable x? So x is the argument. So that means we can, it will receive the values, all possible value values, which in where the it will receive all first arguments. So if I have somewhere in the program, like here, a function application. And the first expression evaluates to the to this. Then the this list here will move into the x. So this means 1, 2 will move into the x. But here is another application of here is another application of up to some term t, and therefore the values of t also will move into x. Yeah, this will also move into x. So therefore we have to know what will be the values of t. So what will be the values of t? Well, the values of t are the second components of this x. So the second component of this x, which moves in there, is, for example, the 2. The list 2. So therefore, besides 1, 2, also the list containing 2 alone will move into the T, and thus also into the X, and then also the second component of this thing, so therefore also the empty list will move into the X. Okay, you can see it. That is so. Then let's see what happens with the with that expression, with the sub expression of the program, which is a match expression. This one. So this is this one. So the value of that then will either be all the values of the y. All the values of the y, or these values. That was wrong. So we are looking at the match expression. So here in that case, it is made in that way that if the if x evaluates to the empty list, we will the value of the match expression will be a function. Now functions are kind of values. No further it simply stops, or this function. So there are two possible functions. Okay, and it turns out that the x, as we have seen, can have a composite value or the empty list, and therefore we will have both functions as values for the match expression. Okay? So this is that kind of piece of thing which we find then for the y. What kind of values will have the y? So that the y will receive, so there are kind of, so you see here that there are two kind of y's, here is a y and there is a y. One might wonder whether different places, whether we disambiguate variables so that every variable is bound at least once, but at most once. But here we have used the same variable twice. This kind of introduces a little bit of imprecision into the analysis, but that is so we simply, so I do not care so for that imprecision. I think it doesn't make a difference. So what is it? So that is, if now that is the question, this y is receives a value whenever we find an application where of an expression which evaluates to the match expression. And now, well, that is kind of something which one has to check, but this expression here, apt, will evaluate to the match expression. Likewise, this one will evaluate to the match expression. Now, since that evaluates to the match expression, the 3 will move into the y, into this y, but the other y is the same. Yeah? But since here in that case the t will also have the value, not only the value 1 semicolon 2, but also 2 and the empty list, then also the values of y, yeah, so then there is another, this also moves into that y. So therefore, I guess if we distinguish these two y's or we do not distinguish, it doesn't make a difference. In essence, the analysis will find out that y will receive the value, this list. Okay, and here I have kind of listed for the other for the other unknowns of the system, the corresponding results. So this h, the t, we have already discussed. That it will have be the tail of the list 1 semicolon 2 or the empty list, and h will receive the value 1,2. So the head of the list is either 1, or it will in a recursive call it will be 2. And so what else will we find? So overall, now what do we find overall? Overall for that expression, we find that it receives which value? Well, it is the value, the body, the value of the body of the function. So let me, that it will, the body of the function to which up 1 semicolon 2 evaluates, the body of that function is either this identity thing, or the, so this is y, or it is the list starting with h and following with a recursive call to up. So that means, so this, since y, the value of y, have, we found is this 3, we have these two elements in the as the two value sub-expressions which possibly may arrive here. And we see here that this is that we have some kind of imprecision in that sense, that it is, it may, that the analysis only finds out that, or may, finds out, cannot exclude that up simply returns the second argument. By that, and I didn't show you the fixed point iteration, how it computes this kind of solution, but we kind of intuitively got the idea that that is the reasonable result. What we also note here that, well, I repeat it again because that the sets on for every unknown is a subset of the subsets of sub-expressions of the program. So therefore, it is finite. And now the only thing is the sub-expressions of the program. Okay, so we found out certain expressions evaluate to certain subsets of expressions. But now what we can do is we can kind of, if we found out that here, and we want to know what really are the values to which the up 1 semicolon 2 and 3 evaluates, we may further look up what are the potential values of h, and then we use these tools, and here we may simply look up what is the values of up t y. And that means we look up the value here. And so we may recursively expand, and every expansion step produces at least one constructor or produces a terminal symbol. A terminal symbol is simply a constant or a function. So, and that means in this example, you could, if we kind of denote if we simply denote the value here as kind of as a non-terminal, if you like, then this A produces either the value 3 or that value, because, let's see, because here this is one potential value of it, and this is another potential value. So this means we have this is as a potential value and that as a potential value, and here again this A occurs, and so we have kind of a context-free grammar. And now we have to know what is the values of H. But here is the values of H. There are two alternatives, which when you write down context-free grammars, you separate the alternatives by this vertical bar. But you may write also a set of potential right-hand sides, so there is it's only notation, but it's no conceptual difference. So what we see here is a context-free grammar. And now this particular context-free grammar is so simple that we kind of can spell out the set of all values which are constructed in that way. And so we see, and that is the set of all these values. Now there is no sub-expressions E prime with containing function applications or match expressions or whatnot, but only constructor applications of functions. That is or operator applications. So all the values which you can construct in that well, this is in this way, this is this L of one of these sub-expressions of the program, and these are the real values which are potential to which an expression potentially may evaluate. So this L of H, therefore, is the set 1, 2, and the L of up T Y consists of all lists where the first elements consist of ones and twos, and the last element is three. So, and now, what is the real value of up ty? Well, no, if we don't apply abstraction, but kind of really look at the programming semantics, and then the real value. Real values would be, okay, so the real values would be 1, 2, 3, or taking the recursive calls into account, also 2, 3, and 3. So in that sense, here we have a little bit of an over-approximation, But it's not so bad an over approximation. It only kind of it finds correctly that here in front of the three there are only ones and twos. That there is only at most one and at most one two. That is kind of goes that is lost in the analysis. But as we do an analysis, we kind of have to. There must be some loss of information because otherwise we would execute the program and the program execution is the programming language is Turing complete. So. There are undecidable problems there. So therefore, this over-approximation is not so bad. Yeah, so that's the message which I would like to tell to you. And now we could kind of... Now comes in this lecture a section where I explain the operational semantics of this type of programs. And this is, in some sense, nice, and it is important if you want to construct such analyses, but I would say, since the semester goes to the end, we kind of skip that kind of semantic part and just continue afterwards. So I will not kind of provide you with this operational semantics and kind of an indication how one proves the correctness of the analysis. Let's just see what we can do with it. Yeah, so here we have now we can do. Let's now return to the this inlining business. So here in this particular case, we find that this f here evaluates to this function. So therefore, we might want to replace this f by that function here, and that is, we would end up in x plus x. But that is a little bit. This is not possible. Why is it not possible? Because there are two x's. Yeah. So there is one x. This is this one. This one here. This one, and there's another x, which is this one. And so if down there, after inlining, we have x plus x, one x is the x1, which is has the value 1, and the other one is the x2, which has the value 2. And so these two kind of variables get messed up. So when we do this inlining, we have to take care that we do not leave the scope. Yeah? So that means... instead of doing that kind of inlining, that is one problem which we encounter, and the other problem which we encounter is if we have recursive functions. So as we have a recursive function here, so then inlining better should not be applied. Now. So one thing to deal with that problems is, so we could do several things. So the first thing is we could introduce unique variable names. So that means this x1 and x2, we would make different by separating that into an x1, defining here an x1 and here an x2. And then we would have... notice that this f here is applied to x1, and that is the x2, while the other one is an x2. Yeah, and that. That is one thing, and then the other thing is what we could do is that we only substitute functions which are in the same scope of the global variables as the applications. So that means we would not do this substitution because the global variable at the place where we do would like to do the substitution, the variable x2 is not visible. So therefore we cannot do the inlining there. Yeah. So that would mean for every sub expression where we potentially might want to do an inlining, we would like to know what are the variables which are what are the global variables which are statically visible there. And that would mean that we determine for every sub expression this set D of E, which determines the set of definitions, the set of variables which are defined, which are can be seen at that place. So now, how do we determine that set? And then we write down a certain set of equations, and in that sense, it is, a non-recursive set. So we can simply do it by passing down information down the syntax tree of the expressions. So assume that this D is the set which arrives at an expression E. So D is a set of variables. And now if E is a let expression, then this D will arrive also at the expression E, 1. And since we made variable names unique, all the variables in D will have names which are distinct from the x1 introduced in the expression E. So therefore, now if I want to know what variables arrive at E0, I just take the variables which arrive at the whole expression and add the x1. And likewise, if I have a functional expression with the formal parameter x, and at that functional expression a set of variables d arrives, then the body of that function is reached by all variables in d plus the formal parameter x. And now similarly, if e is a match expression, and in one pattern, in one case, I have variables x1 to xk, I introduce variables x1 to xk, then the main expression there, so this expression here, kind of is reached by d plus the variables in the pattern. Yeah. And now if we apply that, then we observe that, so here is the, okay, so I left the first x without index, but I just disambiguated by calling the second x x1. And then we observe that at that expression here, the only variables which arrive here are x and f. Yeah? So these are the two variables which arrive at that main expression. And therefore, the x1 does not arrive. So here we have kind of extra variables, and therefore this inlining would not be possible. So now what could we do in this situation? So we could say, okay, so we give up. Or we kind of might say, okay, so we might also do something else. We might kind of do something like you might call it let floating. So kind of move that definition of an unknown outside of that f. So we move it before. So or we might not move it before, we might kind of copy it before. So that we kind of introduce this definition also on the level up, on one level up. So as a resulting program, we would then arrive at that situation. Here we have the definition of x. Here we have another definition. We have a first definition of the x1. Then inside f we have another definition of this x1. And here we have a use of that x1. So now the x1 is duplicated. And so we see that this inner definition here is redundant, because at that point already a variable x1 with a value 2 arrives. So therefore, we can delete this expression, this let, and then arrive at this kind of program. This kind of program. We have now two definitions of x, one behind the other, one followed by the other. And then we have this definition of a function. And now the inlining is possible, because now at that particular expression, so here at that expression, we have both x and x1 are available. So this is in scope, and therefore the inlining can be applied. Now we additionally see that here we have a variable assignment, that y is equal to x, and then subsequently y is used. So then in that place we could directly replace the y with the x. Then we would arrive here, and then that would be in this situation we would find that the definition of f is not used anymore at all in the program. So therefore it could be one could further optimize in saying that this one is dead, and so on, and by that one could simplify this program further, and by and by, in this particular case, we would arrive at 1 plus 2 and then ultimately at 3. But that is perhaps not so surprising, because this is a piece of code returning a constant. That we succeed in inferring the constant is perhaps not so surprising. Okay? So that is one thing. And the other thing is... So you see here there is kind of massaging which you could do to enable to make the inlining stronger. There's another thing which one could do, and that is we might do inlining simply only of functions which do not themselves contain global variables. Then we have no problems at all, and then we can do this inlining. So that is, we only substitute variables without global variables, and there are quite a few. So if you write a helper function like the map function or fold and things like that, these are these functions have no global variables, and you could easily inline them. And the same is for the function which we had last time, this max function, which takes the maximum of two values, returns the maximum of two values, so there's no reason why one shouldn't inline that. So here is again the map function, and see what we have there. So here is one function f, so it's squaring. Then here we have the map function, which takes a function g and maps it over the elements of a list. Yeah. So this is this one, and now we might wonder what can we do here? Now, so we could inline the map function, but then we have encounter another problem. Inlining map is a recursive function. So inlining the map function will not remove the use of map, but will produce another call to the function map. So that is different from the function f. So the function f is not recursive, so if we inline that, then it simply goes away. So That is the first observation which we make, that the actual parameter in the in map G, both in the in will always be the same. And therefore, this map G could be specialized to a new function H, which is defined by as follows. So we introduce a new function H, which takes which is defined as follows. So let G be this x arrow x times x, and then we so this H we have introduced for map G. So therefore, its body is the function which we obtain by specializing the map G, the body of map G. So by just calling so map G, where the function, the actual parameter f, is replaced with G. So that means here that the recursive call here is this one, this map G. Now map G, that was the sub expression for which we introduced the new name H. So therefore, that can be the inner occurrence of this map G can be replaced back again with the H. So that means we have that you could also consider as a not it's an unfold, but it's a fold transformation. That is, you it's not so that you replace a name by its definition, but you replace a definition, you fold it back to the name, and here you fold it back to the H. And if we do that, we have obtained a new definition of the name H, which is like that. So we introduce G as squaring, as the function square. We then match the parameter with the empty list, in which case we return the empty list. And with a non-empty list, in that case, we apply G to the head of the list, and head of the argument, and H to the tail of the argument. And now you see in this definition, this G does not occur anymore. So since G is not used, we can kind of remove it. It occurs. It occurs here. Sorry. The G occurs here, but we can inline it. And that means we replace G by the definition of G. And this let x equals x, this is for the parameter passing. And that means then in the end, so simplifying that here we let x equals x, okay, so that kind of can be removed. And then you see the G is no longer used, so we can also remove this one. So removing useless definitions and variable-variable assignments, we simply then arrive at a specialization of the map function for the particular function G for which it has been called. And this gives us a dedicated function H, which takes an argument list and squares all its elements. And now this is definitely simpler than, and it doesn't use any higher level, higher order functions than the code before. Yeah. So you see here, in order to, this was, what we did here is we tried to simplify. We tried to simplify a call to a higher level function, where, or you could say, we have a function for which parts of the arguments are known. Here in this case, the f is known. And then we want to specialize this particular function map for which some arguments are known to a function, to a dedicated function. And here in this case, it is for the map function, this is possible because the recursive call is again has the same, satisfies the same pattern, namely it is applied it is applied to the same argument as the main call. Yeah, so this F simply is passed around and therefore it stays constant, and that can be detected, and by that we notice that we can use this specialized function H for map applied to the square ring function G. Yeah, and this kind of trick, a compiler may always play. A serious point is, how do we know that at a particular place where a function is applied, do we know its actual parameters? And there our value analysis may help, because it may prove that a certain argument is always this function G, this squaring function, for example. So that is the first point. So our value analysis helps here. And the other thing is, we must be careful that now in the body of here, it was a very simple case, because here in the body, it's always the same G for which the map is applied. But it could be slight variations of it, and then the question is whether we would have not only that this specialization of function applications may kind of start to generate not only a function H, but then an H prime, H double prime, and so on, and you define more and more function definitions, and this specialization may not terminate. And this is a serious problem. So therefore, an alternative could be that the compiler is more humble and only applies this specialization to very particular functions. So for example, only to this map and fold and such functions from the standard library, which are well known and which kind of correspond to very particular patterns. This is one thing which we could do. And the other thing is that you kind of only apply this optimization if immediately in the body of here, of the main, you find the same pattern again. So if you can kind of close the recursion scheme immediately and fold it back immediately to the edge, otherwise you give up and do not do this unfolding. Yeah. So this kind of fold, this specialization of higher order functions, given that certain arguments is known, this is a very important optimization in functional programming. Okay, so this I have, having shown you that, we may kind of have a brief look at another way how to improve functional programs. Not in this case, it is not by simplifying, specializing functions for particular arguments, but by removing intermediate data structures. This kind of transformation, last time, I think it was last time that I briefly kind of intuitively described that to you. This was this deforestation business. And the idea of deforestation, once again, is to remove the data structures which collect intermediate results. And so one thing, one such thing would be, you have a list of data, you map a function over it, you again map another function over it, and this repeatedly, and then at some point you kind of sum up all the results, things like that, or combine them with some fold function. So here, so the map function is one candidate which is used here. Then there is this function filter, which is used, you have these intermediate results, you kind of throw away things which you do not need, not like. This is this filter function. Or this fold function, which then kind of combines the results into one. So it's a fold left here. In OCaml, it's really spelled out, fold left. and that is you have a function, you have a value a which is returned for the empty list, and then the third argument is the list which is folded together. If the list is empty, you return the a. Otherwise, you apply f to the accumulator. You change the accumulator to f applied to a, the old accumulator, and the first element of the list, and then continue folding with the rest of the list. So this is this fold left operation. And, well, there are other things which you could do. You could have the identity, for example, the identity function, which you could have function composition. You might have function composition, and you might have, if you have a binary function, you might do the composite with a unary function, either by doing the composition in the first argument or doing the composition in the second argument. So these are higher order functions, and by these kind of functions you could use to implement meaningful things. So for example, let's see at this little program what is done here. So there is an auxiliary function, so you might so it's not a program, but it's a collection of function definitions. So for example, when you want to determine the sum of the elements in a list, so how can you do it? Well, you fold over the list the plus operator and the initial value 0. That is the way how a functional programmer would implement the sum. No functional programmer would write down a recursive definition for it. Okay, so that is one thing. So then there is the length thing. You could also define in that way. You kind of may use a... you might do it in that way. You map each element in the list to 1 and then sum all the elements. So you may compose the sum function with the this map function. Yeah. So it's like of composing, of map, of sum. So altogether, yeah, of this function sum with the mapping of this particular function f, or you, which is perhaps a little bit idiosyncratic, one could in that case think. So if you, so that would be one way to implement it. There would be another way. How could you do it? You could directly fold. Fold left with a modified function which does the following. It takes this modified function, takes the accumulator and the next element and kind of returns a plus 1. And then you start with 0. And that would be also the length function. Yeah? So this fold, and you see here now these are kind of two definitions of the same thing. So either you map all the elements in the list to 1 first, this gives you an intermediate list, and then you sum all these ones. This is the, that you could do, or you do this one, where you kind of avoid to construct the intermediate list and construct the sum directly. Now, this deforestation kind of, the idea of deforestation is to take that kind of definition and automatically transform it in that one. By that you have removed the intermediate list. And so here in this particular case, one might say, okay, it is contrived to define length in this complicated way. I would directly write it with a fold left. So therefore, this is not a good, perhaps not a good example for the, application of the method, but there's another example, which is this one, which is perhaps more convincing and illustrates a little bit the style how functional programmers think. So here one wants to determine this, the following formula. You have a list of elements x1, x2, and so on, and you want to determine the sum of the xi minus the mean. You want to square it, and afterwards you want to divide it by the number of n. Yeah? So this you want to determine where the x1 to xn is provided by a list. So what would you have to do for that? So the first thing is you have to determine the mean. So that is, you would take the L and you would sum it up. So that is the first thing. Then you have to determine the length of it. And so you call the length function. So this is this one. Then you determine the mean by kind of dividing one by the through the other. Then you kind of subtract the mean from x and map that function over the list, L. Then you square all the elements in the list. And then you sum it up. And then you divide by n. So, so this is kind of, you kind of decompose the different operations which you have step by step. And that is kind of one way how to do it. The nice thing is with such kind of programming, so computing the deviation of a list in this way can be realized without using any explicit recursion. You make a sequence of commands, so to speak. And this is nice because we think in a sequence of steps, and so in that sense it's intellectually pleasing and easy and nice to program. But it is in some sense extremely stupid, as every new step introduces intermediate data structure. So here you kind of, the same list, you map something over the list, it's a new list which you create, you map another thing, a new list which you create, and only then you sum it up. So you have a lot of intermediate lists which one might want to remove. So for the length, I have shown you already how one can remove the intermediate list. This would end up in that kind of definition. And the same would hold also true for computing the deviation. Now, how can we arrive at such kind of this improved computation? So for that, we may think of collecting certain simplification rules. So, for example, if we kind of compose the identity with the function, then this we do not have to do. We can simply take the function. So mapping the identity over a list is simply the list, so we can avoid this mapping. And likewise, so here are these other compositions with the identity which also can be optimized away. And here, so this mapping the identity function over a list also means, that's simply nothing. Now, these are the identity rules. There you might say, okay, identity, we'd never write down an identity function, so therefore this is these yellow rules are kind of an exercise, but not really helpful. But the next kind of rule is a helpful rule. And that is, if I first map a function g over a list, and then map a function g f over the list, and I compose these, I could also kind of first compose the functions f and g, and then map the composed function. And by that, I have, by kind of replacing that expression here with that expression, I have removed an intermediate data structure. And likewise, and that is now again an interesting thing, that is perhaps slightly more, if I first map a function g over a list, and then fold the results together by means of a function f, I could also kind of do this mapping together with the folding. That is, I compose the F and the G and map the composition over the list. So there's a little bit of a problematic thing. This only works well if both these functions F and G necessarily terminate. If they do not terminate, we run into problem. So it could be that mapping the G over the whole list may not terminate over the whole, may not terminate in all cases, and then folding F over, so then that means that the argument of fold left would never be computed and the whole thing does not terminate, while the composition of F and G may be in such a way that the G is never called. And that means in this case the composition of F and G may never call the G, and so that would mean that the left side here might have a better termination behavior than the right hand side. So the right hand side may have a better termination behavior than the left hand side. So therefore, if one has an O'Connell type of language with a strict evaluation of call by value evaluation strategy, these two expressions may not be the same. And the same holds true here in this composition thing. It may be that the composition of F and G may terminate. Is it like that? The composition of... No, that is not true. No, let me think. The composition... Let us see how this... May I... Do I speak... No, it's not true. I think it's not true. Maybe these are really eternally true. Here in the composition here, if I have a call by value evaluation strategy, before I can apply F, I have to evaluate that, and I have to evaluate G. No, that is so. That was not true. So that, yeah, so you. One thing is true. You have to be careful that maybe by these compositions may change the termination behavior. But for these particular rules, I guess it's not true. The composition is defined in such a way that also in a call by value environment, this will not terminate whenever that here would not terminate. Yeah. Okay. So now you see here. So these are kind of the core rules by which we want to eliminate intermediate data structures by combining several maps or combining a fold with a map. So if you think of, you have 20 maps and then one fold, then applying these rules you can kind of shrink together all maps into one and then apply the fold and then ultimately shrink everything to a single fold. There are So here are some more things which one might think of. So if you have filter operations, you do not always have these maps. You might have also this filtering, but then it turns out that filtering twice can be combined to filtering once, and filtering and mapping. And filtering and folding can also be combined. So that is that filtering and folding can also be combined. And filtering and folding can also be combined. And maybe one can even think of mapping and filtering. Mapping and filtering, let me think of. Yeah, no. Yeah, mapping, and so, and since now if you have a sequence of filters and maps and then an outermost fold, how can one also combine it into one? Then the answer is yes. One would do it in such a way. So if you have you have a fold outside, then you have map, then you have map star, then you have a filter, then you have again map star and another filter. So how would one proceed? The first step would be one combines the fold left together with the neighboring maps kind of into one fold. By that one would get rid of this here. Then the first filter could also be kind of the leftmost filter could be merged into the fold. So then this disappears. So then the next map star can be swallowed by the fold left, and again then the next filter comes, and so on. So that means in this way, if you have a fold left and arbitrarily mixtures of filter and map operations, all that can be merged into a single fold operation, even if filter and map not directly can be merged together, but all of them can be merged into the fold. So that is one thing. But so these are nice rules, and since they improve the behavior of the program, one would like to apply them. But they are not as trivial to be applied as possible as one might have hoped, because. May I go back? Here you see the rules, how I have written them down. They are all kind of written down in a variable-free fashion, in that we have here always, we write, okay, I have the composition of this map and that map. But in the code, you will not see this composition, but you often will see things like that. You have map F applied to map G and then some L. So that is, you see the difference. So there is this L here to which the two maps are applied, and you now have to see it's a kind of a different form, a different presentation of the same situation, and you may want then to replace this green variant of an expression by that green variant. So this means this comp here may not be present, but instead we may apply the two functions directly to some code, or even in worse, we might see things like that. So we might see L equals map GL, and then we see again an L equals map FL in series. So even there you have to see that there is a function composition going on. So that means there are several syntactic representations of a particular pattern where you can apply the transformation. And therefore the crux with applying these deforestation transformations is to detect the opportunities where you can apply the rule. And here I have written down this second kind of representation of the rules, not only for the map but also for the fold. For the fold that is here, or for the filter which is here, or the combination of fold and filter which is here. Okay, so this means the idea is for this deforestation is simple. The application of this transformation to real code is maybe not so simple. So let's see what the optimization will yield when applied to our trivial example. So for sum, we have already a very succinct representation by means of fold. For the length, we would compose the plus for the folding and the constant one function to have an optimized evaluation. And now this thing here could be further optimized by means of inlining, resulting in the end. So maybe I go resulting in the end resulting in the end in this in a function which takes an argument and simply increments it. Okay, so that is for the length. Now for the deviation, the computation of the deviation, what would we do there? Okay, so the length, the sum of the elements to determine that, there's no optimization possible anymore. Determining the length, also no optimization possible. Now it comes for this expression, subtracting the means, squaring, and summing. And these three things, so these are two maps followed by a fold. So the two maps would result in that composition. So we have to do the composition of these two functions. And then we have to do this composition two of this plus function for the summing with that function f. So this is this g. And this resulting function g then is folded over the list L. So in essence, you see here that indeed all the intermediate data structures have disappeared, and there's only the list L, which is used several times, and in the end, from the list L of inputs, then the ultimate result is computed. You see here that in that composition, there is still room for optimization, and that kind of optimization can be done by means of inlining. Yeah. And doing that inlining would find out that the function g takes two arguments. There we have, that means we have inlined this function comp2, and we would also inline this function comp, and that would result in function in variable definitions x1 equals x minus mean x2 equals x times x1 times x1, and then one adds this to the accumulator A. And so all together, so this function then is folded, used for folding over the list. And then in that particular case, now in the very end, we could also apply to this function here this specialization, the specialization which we apply to the map. So a similar form of specialization for this particular specific function g, and then get a function without higher level functions, without fold, which is just a recursive function which performs a sequence of lets and then tail recursively calls itself. And since it's tail recursive, then this kind of can be optimized by the compiler to something which is essentially a loop. So altogether, doing this deforestation followed by this inlining and then this specialization and tail recursion optimization, but altogether ends up in something which essentially is a loop for that program. Yeah. A loop whose body is a sequence of let definitions. Okay. And now, so we found out that this mapping, filtering, and folding kind of can be merged into one. But there are more things. There's another interesting point, that the list of results where we apply then map and all these things might also be generated, might, may not be generated, may not come from heaven or so, or from the outside world, but this list may in some cases be created by tabulation of a unary function. So if we have a tab, so here is how you might tabulate it. You may assume that the first element is f applied to 0, the next one is f applied to 1, and so on until n minus 1. So, and that is that kind of, so for that one might, to create such a function, we may introduce this tabulate function, which is tail recursively, which is computed by means of this auxiliary function tabulate prime, which takes a j and then tabulates until n. So it takes a j, an f, and an n, and if the j is at least n, then it returns the empty list, and otherwise it applies f to the j, so this is for the tabulation, and calls tabulate prime with j plus 1, f, and n. So n is the length which is provided as the last argument. So that means if you this tabulate function, therefore, the tabulate function therefore takes an f and an n, and so the n is coming to the very end, and then tabulates f until into a list of length n. Okay, so now we may wonder, how does this tabulation cooperate with mapping and folding? And clearly, what we immediately observe, that when we tabulate g and map over the result f, we could as well tabulate the composition of f and g. And likewise, if we compose a fold with a tabulation, then we could directly produce the answer without computing any intermediate list by introducing this loop thing. And this loop thing simply is a tail recursive function which accumulates results in an accumulates values in an accumulator, where the next value to be combined into the accumulator is determined by means of the index, some index j. So this looping function, uses an auxiliary function loop prime, which takes this loop index. This loop prime is like a for loop. So this j is the index. It runs until n, which is the last argument, and in between it repeatedly applies this function f, and and additionally it has this accumulator a. And now what does it do? If sufficiently many iterations have been done, the accumulator is returned, and otherwise the loop prime is called again with an increased loop parameter, and the same function f, where the accumulator has been changed by applying f to a and the current value of the iterator. So this is the update function, if you like. So that's it, and then you start with the loop with 0, and then you get a result, and then n times the function f is iterated. So this means all the list of intermediate result has completely disappeared. And additionally, we find here that this map again. So this these three things, fold, map, and tabulate, kind of nicely fit together and allow to, in some cases at least, to remove all lists which occur in between. But that is the end for today. We meet again tomorrow, I guess, at 8:30. Thank you.